are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 11th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, financial journalist and author Nicholas Shaxson on the finance curse, how global finance is making us all poorer. Also on the program today, Bolivia in the throes of a U.S.-enabled violent coup. And public impeachment hearings start this week, all day Wednesday. We'll be covering them live. Last week's elections across the country still yielding big left-wing wins. And the famously Islamophobic Congressman Peter King to not seek re-election this year. Sad, sad sounds. Meanwhile, speaking of sad, Pete Buttigieg creeping up in Iowa in the wake of the biggest campaign rally in 2019 when AOC came to town. Meanwhile, what is John Bolton's game? He wants to testify, but he wants to be made to testify. And Democrats softly and silently kill an abused NSA spying program. And the Democrats take a key step to finally ratifying the ERA. Lastly, the Supreme Court to hear DACA arguments, all this and more. Oh, and Lula is out of prison. I guess that happened over the weekend. I thought that was...
It happened on Friday, and he's already done two major rallies.
All this and more on today's program. I feel like that happened like a week ago.
We did that. We were talking about live on air on Saturday. He did a major rally at the Metal Workers Union, and Steve Bannon said he's the chief of the globalists.
There you go. Chief globalist. Ladies and gentlemen, happy Veterans Day. If you are a veteran, if you have someone in your family who's a veteran, offer our thanks and in some respects, our apologies that our civilian leadership couldn't do a better job of keeping you from being in a conflict if you were, in fact, in a conflict. Just one quick note on that regard. There was a story in the Washington Post. I guess it was a... an op-ed by the executive director of the Connecticut Veterans Legal Center. And this guy, Liam Brennan, is talking about the more than 500,000 former service members who received an other than honorable discharge. And as such, they are ineligible for VA services. According to the GAO, in 2017, 62% of the 92,000 service members discharged for misconduct between 2011 and 2015 were diagnosed with PTSD. And the thing about the Veterans Administration, their system of hospitals, and yes, there have been in times... some problems. But broadly speaking, not only is it sort of an amazing government agency in terms of and huge in terms of what it runs and the sophistication of what it runs, in terms of the medical care, it has medical care that you cannot get anywhere else, because in civilian medical care, you just don't come across the same type of injuries, whether they are mental or emotional or physical, that you do amongst the military population. And so they're providing a specific, a unique service. But at the very least, if we were to have a Medicare for all type of system, none of this would be nearly as relevant in terms of so many of our vets being homeless or having substance abuse program problems, et cetera. So we can celebrate our vets by actually improving the situation for tens of millions of other people in this country as well. But I don't know that we'll do that, but we hope spring's eternal. So just wanted to mention that on Veterans Day. All right, let's move along. This was a fun clip. You know, there's been a renewed vigor by billionaires who seem to be freaking out at the prospect of either Bernie or Warren winning. And they've really spent their targeted their ire over the past week or two on Warren. I suspect simply because they are of the belief that Bernie is not a significant electoral threat. I think they're going to be mistaken. They're mistaken in that assessment, and I suspect we will hear them talk about Bernie later. But they, right for the time being, have been going after Warren, and it's been nice because now they're getting a little bit more exposed. They're engaging in this fight, and that is good because they can't win the rhetorical argument. They're going to win the other part, or very likely.
The stuff about power.
Exactly. Because of the billions and billions of dollars they have. But for every Michael Bloomberg that throws his hat into the race, there's another billionaire somewhere just trying to lay low, or one who's just trying to seem like, well, I'm one of the good guys. Like Jamie Dimon, when we heard during the financial crisis, it was Chase was supposedly the good bank.
Hashtag not all billionaires.
Exactly.
That was even worse. That was literally not all banks.
Right.
Like as an institution.
Now, I don't know if Jamie Dimon is specifically a billionaire, but
I think so.
He's extremely wealthy. 100 millionaire, several times over at the very least. And here is Leslie Stahl.
He's a billionaire.
He is a billionaire. Ah, there you go. Here's Leslie Stahl asking, and they really don't like it when you're not stroking them. And when you sit down with 60 Minutes, like even then, like, how dare you? Here is Leslie Stahl asking a fairly benign question.
Executive pay. Last year, you were paid $31 million. Too high?
The board sets mine. I have nothing to do with it.
Well, you could return some of it.
Now, this is amazing. This guy, it's like won the lottery. I have nothing to do with what I get paid. That's fascinating. He's the only guy in America who doesn't just like, bliff, $31 million, $3,500, whatever the board says. There you go.
Nothing to do with it.
Oh, pause. You know who points the board? Well, I think it's the CEO who gets to at least nominate some people, right? Somebody's got to appoint people to the board. Suggests, serves up. Is it? Who is it? I don't know.
I think I'm looking at what Jamie Dimon's titles are to see if his relationship to it.
Well, I'm sure.
That's mine. I have nothing to do with it.
Well, you could return some of it.
I could. Is that going to solve any of those problems?
I don't know.
Is it going to solve any of those problems?
No, but you could set an example, say, I'm not going to take all that money. Okay. I don't need it.
I could. I'm going to leave it to the board to set my comp. Not you, not the press.
You've answered
my board,
every one of my questions, but this one you're fobbing off.
Yeah, the board has to do it.
Well, let me ask it in a general way. Should executive pay in this country be curbed?
What does that mean?
Cut back. Should there be a way to say we're not going to have...
I mean, what could he possibly have been mistaken? Like, I'm very confused. Like, curbed?
Curb your dog?
You mean like what? Picked up off the ground? I don't understand.
Hold on.
And this is, you know, he's all like, I'm not going to answer this specific question about me. Give me a general question. A general question? Oh, I don't understand what you're talking about.
Should executive pay in this country be curbed?
What does that mean?
Cut back. Should there be a way to say we're not going to have such a spread between our workers and the guy at the top?
You know, when you say something like that, you got to say, how are you going to do it? What does it make sense? I think you use the tax system to do that. I would not have cut the tax on the rich. I would have expended your earned income tax credit instead, which is like a negative income tax for lower paid people. We probably should change the minimum wage, which I don't think has been changed for like 10 or 15 years. There are solutions to these problems. The problems are real. It does not mean free enterprise.
Okay, well, now I'll tell you what's encouraging is that you have Jamie Dimon publicly promoting these things. Now, the reason he's doing that is because he wants to maintain all of his money, his obscene amount of wealth that has come, at least in part, not totally, but from the immiseration of other people. That's just the bottom line. In fact, our next guest is going to be talking about that over-financialization. But it is also unstable. And that's why I think he knows, like, well, can't we shore things up? But if you were reminded of something of Jamie Dimon's appearance on 60 Minutes, I think I know what it is. It was this moment from the fake 60 Minutes on Saturday Night Live over 30 years ago.
Pardon me for saying this, but you seem defensive.
I'm not being defensive. You're the one who's being defensive. Why is it always the other person who's being defensive?
Life imitates
that
art.
Martin Short line. That's so clever. Why is it always the other person who's being defensive?
Folks, my transformation is complete. Every single pair of underwear I own is now an Everlane pair of underwear. There you go. Thank you very much. Hey, now, you know what? I mean, it is a big deal because when you get to be my age, advanced in years, breaking your habits are not easy to do. It has to be something absolutely special, and I'm super psyched about it.
One second. I'm sorry. And I like to give you a hard time, and deservedly so, but are you really officially advanced in years?
I am advanced in years,
wow.
Of course.
All right. There I don't go. Know why I want to say that, but okay.
Not to mention, that's just one of the upshots about Everlane. Everlane makes premium essentials using the finest materials without traditional markups. Would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? Well, I wouldn't. And Everlane wants you to know what you're paying for and why. So they are radically transparent about their real costs in every step of their process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work on. Not to mention the essentials, like their cotton crew t-shirt, are exactly what they should be. Versatile, simple, stylish, and made from quality materials, which reminds me, Brendan told me the best hoodie he has is from Everlane. Is that it right there? I have that one. I also need one that's zipped, though.
He does look cozy.
Everlane's clothes look better, they cost less, and they last longer. They have 100% grade A cashmere. They have a cashmere hoodie. Maybe you want to get on that. They have quality cotton basics, like I say. Amazing underwear. They have premium Japanese denim made at the world's cleanest denim factory. They have Italian made leather shoes, and they have perfectly fit Oxford shirts. Right now, you can check out our personalized collection at everlane.com/majority. Plus, get free shipping on your first order. Go to everlane.com/majority. Everlane.com/majority. Check it out, folks. It's very rare that I find clothes stores that I wholeheartedly embrace, and it's happened for me with Everlane. On the other end of the spectrum, however, over 100 million people have had their personal information stolen in a major data breach. See, it feels like this happens every day, and then you don't find out about it until 6 months later. Social security numbers, contact details, credit scores, more, all taken from Capital One customers. These kinds of attacks, like I say, are getting more and more frequent. It's not just Capital One. Equifax, the company that's supposed to maintain your credit rating. Facebook, eBay, Uber, PlayStation, Yahoo, they've all leaked passwords, credit cards, and bank numbers belonging to billions of users. That's why you need ExpressVPN. You can't control how big corporations mishandle your data, but you can protect yourself. ExpressVPN is an app for your computer and phone that encrypts and secures your data. If you care about your privacy and safety, you shouldn't go online without ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN connects with just one click, so it's super easy. It's lightning fast, and it costs less than $7 a month. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN provider by TechRadar, CNET, The Verge, countless others. Go to expressvpn.com/majority right now to arm yourself with an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show. Protect yourself. ExpressVPN.com/majority for an extra 3 months free. And lastly, nobody's got any time left. Nobody. I mean, I'm not saying we're all going to die, although that's possible. But
it's an interesting way to begin an ad.
Well, look, whether it's just like you don't have the time in the week that you need, or you just don't have much time left for all of us. You want to go out well-versed and knowledgeable. So if you feel like you can't find the time to read all the books on your list, Blinkist is an app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know condensed down to 15 minutes. You can read it. You can listen to it. All on the app. Blinkist is really unique. It works on your phone, works on your tablet, works in your web browser. Find everything from health and self-help titles to history and business books included in Blinkist library. You know that I've talked about like the perfect example of this. With all due respect to Tim Ferriss, I was not going to read the entire 4-hour work week, or frankly, what was it, the 4-hour diet or something like that?
I only know the work week.
He does a whole series of them, and I wasn't going to read them. But I was interested in them because anything I can do to make more time for myself, those are the type of books in the 4-hour.
Remember what you said, though?
What?
You said, less time, but more coconut.
That's right.
That was how when you got on a coconut kit.
That's when
after
I did
reading
the,
Ferriss.
It did not
work less, but lots more
what
coconut.
What do you call it? Bulletproof.
Bulletproof. Yes, I remember that.
But that is a perfect example. You get the key takeaways, 15 minutes, boom, you're done. The Power of Habits by Charles Duhigg, same thing. I'm not going to read the whole book, but I want the key takeaways. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. So instead, I'll play chess with Saul for an extra 15 minutes or 20 minutes. So I'm not spending it reading a book that, you know, I just need the takeaways. I don't need to hear the prose. It's all the books you want for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for our listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Try it for free for 7 days and then save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority to start your free 7-day trial and save 25% off. Of course, if you go to our podcast subscription or our YouTube subscription, you will find that link there. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nicholas Shaxson, author of The Finance Course, How Global Finance is Making Us All Poorer. Be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program financial journalist and author of The Finance Curse, How Global Finance is Making Us All Poorer, Nicholas Shaxson. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Pleasure to talk to you.
And you did two versions of this book. One is the one is a British version. One is a U.S. version. The story is largely the same. Some of the examples are a little bit different. We'll focus on the American ones so that people know what you know, can have a little bit more sense of, like, I guess, of familiarity with these things. But the broader story is this move to financialize essentially our economy. Will you just walk us through basically, I guess, from Bretton Woods, which you cite as sort of the, I guess, the sort of the standard from where we started, and then over time we fell.
Yes, I mean, historically there has been. There have been periods of kind of conflict between the financial sector and what you might call the mainstream economy, the rest of the economy. The Bretton Woods period after the Second World War was a period when countries came together and there was a huge political willingness to do something about the financial sector, which had previously, you know, the Great Depression was still in people's minds, which was very substantially caused by financial deregulation. They decided to put in place an international cooperative architecture that would effectively crunch the financial sector in many countries right down, restrict it with heavy regulations, break up big banks, and put in a lot of high tax rates and, you know, very, very progressive policies. And the finance, you know, this is called an era of financial repression, when the financial sector was really very heavily restricted, and they were furious about it. But that was a period of the highest economic growth in world history, when all these very progressive policies were in place. Before or since, there has never been a period of sustained economic growth around the world in different countries, the United States and elsewhere, as that period when finance was very heavily suppressed. Not only that, but when the financial sector was suppressed, you had a very growth was very broad based. Inequality was falling. There was just, you know, this is the era of the American dream, and there's all sorts of different terms in different countries to talk about this period. Then we had the 1970s, when there was a crisis era when there was a lot of finance moving increasingly quickly around the globe. It was able to escape the constraints of the Bretton Woods system, and you started getting ideological changes when there was deregulation, financial deregulation, and people said, look, guys, this isn't working. We're going to have to loosen financing. We want more credit in our economies. And so they loosened regulations, and the financial sector from that era really began growing very substantially until the global financial crisis. And that period was an era of falling growth and also rising inequality. And this kind of speaks to one of the central themes of my book, which is that, as I put it crudely, too much finance can make you poor. It's kind of a paradox. You know, we all need a financial sector, but once it grows beyond a certain size and beyond its useful roles, it starts to turn nasty. It starts to have harmful and predatory effects in your economy. And so that's kind of the essence of the finance curse thesis.
Okay, and so I mean, just so that people know, Bretton Woods obviously was a meeting that took place in New Hampshire. There was I don't know, something near 50 allied nations there. The Soviets attended at the time, but declined to ratify the final agreements. What I mean, and maybe we can circle back to get a sense of, like, what, you know, what was happening in parallel as that system began to sort of cave. I mean, at the time, I know the Soviets had said that the institutions they had created were essentially tools of Wall Street, and maybe they were somewhat dormant on some level for a while, but. Let's, while we're here, When we say finance, will you just give a more explicit definition for folks that so that people can really wrap their minds on this? Because when we, you know, we hear quite a bit the financialization of the economy, I'm not sure that people fully understand what that means.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, I take finance, I look at finance in a very broad form, and I see it kind of like the rings of an onion. So right at the center, you have the, you know, the traditional banks and particularly the big banks. And then outside of that, you have more esoteric institutions, investment funds, and, you know, shadow banking institutions, things that are outside the normal banking regulation, some of them very kind of esoteric. You know, we're talking trillions of dollars here. So that's the sort of central part of the financial system. But the other part is what you call, what you've referred to as financialization. And what that is the kind of penetration of finance, of financial tools, of financial institutions, financial techniques into other parts of the economy, into agriculture, into manufacturing, into big technology, into tourism, whatever. Every other sector of the economy has been subject to what you might call financialization. I've recently been in Iowa, and I have a chapter on agriculture in Iowa in my book. And you see a whole period of time, again, sort of starting in the 70s with all sorts of things happening. But you see a real change in, I mean, I looked at the hog farming sector, and there's been a tremendous transformation in hogs and in poultry, where you used to have large numbers of independent family farms and also large numbers of meat lockers and other kind of, you know, market institutions that allowed a sort of independent competitive market to thrive. And over time, you saw the arrival of money, particularly from, you know, Wall Street, Chicago, you know, big money center banking started to take over and started to displace the sort of local relationship banking that was the sort of heart and soul of this system. And what you saw then was a period, I mean, there's lots of reasons for why some of the agricultural, the small communities in Iowa and other parts of the Midwest have kind of shrunk. And, you know, if you go to a lot of these small towns, you know, once thriving businesses have shuttered up. I mean, I was walking down the high street of Williams, Iowa yesterday and looking at all the shops I was being shown, all the shops that used to be open, and there's almost nothing left now. And there are various reasons for this. I mean, mechanization and, you know, the rise of, you know, tractors and seed technology and things like that have displaced a certain number of workers. But one of the things, and that's kind of seen as progress and unavoidable and, you know, just the way things have gone. But I think one of the things that people are missing is that there's also been this financialization element going on. So what you've had is a the change from a system where money used to kind of stay much more in the local economy. When you had a system of lots of independent farmers, they would be buying from the local seed merchant, from the local parts supplier. They would be going to the local doctor and the local vet. But what you've had happening since then is these small independent farmers have been squeezed out by big agricultural firms, very big agricultural firms, with a lot of money from the big money centers financing this change. And what you've seen is this, these kind of local circulatory mechanisms where money was sort of staying in the local economy, these have sort of been unrolled and turned more into more of a conveyor belt. So the wealth is that used to be circulating locally is now kind of being shipped out, shipped outwards to, you know, the big money centers, to state capitals, but also internationally, it's going offshore. It's going, you know, two of the biggest firms are JBS and Smithfield, which are respectively Brazilian and Chinese. So a lot of this money, this wealth, you know, while you've had mechanization and technology massively increasing yields, you know, the actual wealth that's been created and coming out of the ground, you have paradoxically been seeing a kind of impoverishment of many of these communities. And there's, you know, it's this same paradox, you know, more money coming into the system, but many of these communities seem to be poorer than they were. And this, for me, is very significantly a story of financialization. And I think one of the, you know, one of the hopeful messages of this book and one of the hopeful messages of this particular story of hog farming is that even though, you know, the rise in technology and the improvement of yields and all that is progress, and it's, you know, some jobs have been lost, but that's, there is an inevitability about this. This financial side of things, that what I call the finance curse, the financialization of the agricultural economy is reversible, And you can do that, and you can break up these big agricultural firms and you know, return competition to these sectors, and you can reduce the use of tax havens and all these kind of tricks and techniques that are being used to extract wealth and create a new kind of economy.
Well, I want to circle back on some of those solutions and how we roll this back. But can you be more specific in terms of the way that this money is extracted from Iowa? So, for instance, or we can use you talk about a New Jersey newspaper, which has this extraction is, you know, and I think maybe that's easier for people to see because we have examples of it almost every day, whether it's, you know, sort of local newspapers or we see it in the context of online journalism, where wealth is being extracted and the localities are being impoverished by this. I mean, just so that people can see this dynamic, because it's one thing to say like, okay, well, the money just somehow, you know, is spent outside of the community, but there's more that's going on here, right? Like these are firms, and maybe it's the entree into this is through the private equity firms. The money is being extracted, and almost the business is almost secondary to extracting all the value out of it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think private equity is a very good way to illustrate what's going on here. Private equity firms, their basic business model is to go in and buy up companies, again, across the economy, from agriculture or newspapers or manufacturing or whatever, and to take those companies and then to try and make a profit for their investors. So the private equity, you know, the moguls, the titans, they will get co-investors, your pension funds, whatever, will come in alongside them. They'll have a huge pot of money and they'll invest, they'll buy up companies. Usually these are perfectly healthy company, productive companies with good, strong cash flows. That's what they're generally most interested in. And they buy these companies up. And then what they do is they take those cash flows and they do kind of financial engineering. And the way they do this is they identify all the stakeholders of that company once they've got it, once they've got control of it. And they say, okay, let's look. Okay, this one stakeholder is the workers. So let's now reduce their benefits. Let's now crush the unions, and let's now get some more money out of workers. So they will do that. And in the case of the newspaper I was talking to, there was the Trentonian. There had been a huge reduction in staffing levels, and they had been you know, working conditions were much worse than they used to be. So there was money kind of, you know, there's money kind of taken out of workers, and new cash flows are generated for them. Then they will go off to maybe the pension fund, and they'll say, right, there's the terms of the pension fund are too generous. Let's, you know, take some money out of that. They might go after the company's suppliers and put more onerous terms on them or pay them late or whatever. Then maybe they might think, okay, we're in a niche here and we want to monopolize this market niche. So let's buy up a load of companies that are doing the same sort of stuff. And then we kind of control all or most of them. Once we've got that, we've got market power, and then we can, you know, we can get more money. We can raise our prices or we can reduce wages to workers even further. And we can get even more money from this stakeholder group. And so they do this kind of, look at all the different stakeholders, and they just extract more money. They also will tend to make the company that they've bought take on a huge amount of debt. And this is important, that the actual owners, the moguls, the titans, are not the ones who are on the hook for this debt. They hang the debt on the shoulders of the company that they've bought. So now you've got a much more indebted company, and the proceeds of that borrowing that company has been made, they now funnel it up in special dividends to the actual owners of the company. So the owners of the companies get very rich indeed. In many cases, whether or not the underlying company that they bought actually succeeds. So you have a hugely indebted company that may fail, it may go bankrupt, but they have already paid this special dividend, this huge special dividend to the owners, and the owners may have already made all their money back and then some by financially engineering these cash flows, taking more money out of all the stakeholders, and paying themselves these huge special dividends. So you end up with a fragilized economy, but some very rich people indeed. And you know, some of the, you know, people look at these billionaires and they say, well, this is a sign of economic success. But in many times, in many cases, in terms of this kind of financialization, it is the flip side of impoverishment, impoverishment elsewhere. It is kind of the flip side of economic failure.
Toys R Us is a great example of that type of leverage buyout, and then larding up the company with debt, everybody walking away, and people losing their jobs and their pensions and whatever it was. But we see this all over the place. So with this private equity model, essentially, where it comes in, extracts all the wealth, does not care about the community or really the future of the business. I mean, at one point, right? It's just like it's many wealth. We see this in hospitals quite a bit around the country, in this country as well, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the healthcare sector is there's a huge amount of extraction going on there, and I think a lot of that is local monopolization. I think, yep, you know, private equity firms and others. You know, it's not just private equity firms, but private equity has kind of, in many cases, spearheaded and designed these financial techniques that are then copied by all sorts of other players. And they will go into the healthcare sector and they will look at a local market. You know, they may not have a national monopoly on something, but they may have a local monopoly on provision of healthcare services. And then once they've got a lock on that market, they have market power and they can just jack up the prices. And alongside that, they will be using all sorts of tax haven strategies and all sorts of other financial techniques, using debt and, you know, very complicated financial engineering to juice the returns to the owners of those companies.
Let's talk about tax havens and tax avoidance. I think when most of us here think about that, we think about the Grand Cayman Islands or some such place. But you also talk about South Dakota.
Well, yes, indeed. One of the things, I actually wrote a book about tax havens about 10 years ago called Treasure Islands, where I looked at the whole offshore system. And one of the great revelations for me as I was looking into this was that tax havens are not where we think they are. One of the biggest, and arguably the biggest player in the whole system of offshore tax havens is the United Kingdom, Britain, my country. Where you have the City of London financial center surrounded by a kind of network of satellite tax havens, from the Cayman Islands to the British Virgin Islands to Bermuda to Jersey, a whole lot of others. But also there are all sorts of little, the whole offshore system of tax havens is like an ecosystem with lots of different niches and lots of different players all over the place providing different services. So South Dakota was very interesting. If you go to Sioux Falls, there's a kind of main street where there's a few of these basically wealth management companies, and they are offering services to billionaires and very wealthy people to help them escape paying taxes. And they've got all sorts of tricks they use trusts and many other mechanisms to help them escape paying taxes and also escape other rules and regulations that they may not like. And for me, you know, Sioux Falls illustrated one of the, you know, again, one of the great themes of the finance curse, this idea that, you know, the money that all these trillions that you see, these billionaires and all this money that seems to be circulating in these places doesn't seem to actually be trickling down to the ordinary people who work in these places. So if you go to Sioux Falls, you know, the main street where all that money is, there's nothing very impressive there. You know, you'd think with all this billionaire wealth circulating on paper through these places that there would be a lot more kind of trickle down, a lot more wealth generated locally. But in fact, you know, it's just a couple of hundred jobs really that have been created at the expense of much, much larger losses to U.S. taxpayers elsewhere.
What are the circumstances that Sioux Falls becomes, that South Dakota becomes this magnet as opposed to, say, I don't know, New York State or New Jersey?
Well, South Dakota has got a 0% tax rate for certain aspects of you know, the way you structure your financial affairs, and It is also the other thing about South Dakota is that it is a very small state. And this is kind of in parallel to other tax havens. A lot of the most important tax havens in the world, like the Cayman Islands, are very small states. And the main reason for this is that big finance, big global mobile finance is able to influence the legislatures of these places, able to influence lawmakers much more easily in a very small state, where you can kind of, you know, somewhere like Bermuda with just 50,000 people, but, you know, some of the biggest companies in the world and many billionaires coming there, they can have enormous influence. You know, they come into these little places and often the lawmakers, you know, don't have particular expertise in finance. And you have these accountants and lawyers coming in with incredibly complicated legislation saying, look, you need to approve this and, you know, you'll make a lot of money. And so generally, it's quite easy to influence the legislatures of these places to change the laws, to create, you know, for example, a secrecy law. And, of course, the South Dakota has some very powerful secrecy laws that if you incorporate in that state, you know, you'll be able to cast a veil over your financial affairs. That's another big aspect of it. But I think this idea of what, you know, kind of the political capture of the state of the state is very strong in these small places. It'd be much more difficult in a place like New York because you have all these Democratic constituencies to go up against. Whereas in these small places, you can just get what you want if you're, you know, big finance.
I wish I could take your response and frame it on the wall for every debate I have with so-called libertarians, really sort of neo-Confederates, as to why bigger actually can be better in that regard. I've tried to make people understand that dynamic of smaller entities can be much more easily bought by much bigger, wealthier entities. It just becomes, you know, sort of cat's play for them.
Yeah, exactly. And there's another thing. There's another aspect of this is that states kind of compete with each other. You know, one state puts in place a very clever secrecy law, and another state will look at that and say, "Hey, we can do something even cleverer and more devious than that." So they put something in, and then the first state or other states join in and put in something even worse. So you kind of get this race to the bottom, this spiral to the bottom of, you know, deeper secrecy and more relaxed regulation and stuff like this going on all the time among U.S. states, but it's also going on internationally between countries.
You also at least allude to the problem of fake news. And when we talk about this regime of financialization that has taken over, where you know, you have holding companies or private equity owning hospitals and nurses' shifts, hours, and how long they have to work is being dictated by people who simply want to extract more wealth out of these hospitals. And so they're developing, you know, procedures, essentially, based upon how much more money they can take out of these hospitals or whatever it is, as an example. But this exists, or they've been able to do this, or they've been aided by the fake news of that you say comes from the economics profession. Do tell.
Yeah, so, you know, there's various flavors of fake news. I mean, there's the stuff we all know about that is just kind of, you know, lies and all that stuff that we see on our airwaves all the time. But when I'm talking, you know, I spend a bit of time talking about the fake news that comes out of the financial sector, which is really, it has so much influence over our cultures, our media, our political system, that you get a kind of consensus happening. And again, I would, you know, take the private equity example again. One of the probably the biggest tool in the private equity toolbox for making money is what I call what's known as other people's money, OPM. And what happens is you get the moguls coming in and they attract other co-investors to, you know, put their money with them, and then they invest them and they take huge fees out of, and the fees depend on how much OPM, how many billions they've got to people to come and co-invest alongside them. So to attract this OPM, this other people's money, you need to basically, you need to get involved in storytelling, telling, you know, why I'm the greatest, why you must invest with us, and why it's important to give me your money. And so much of the financial sector has become about storytelling, about trying to say that we need, you know, we need these things, we'll have more billions. You know, you, just this simple idea that, you know, all these billionaires are rich, therefore you're going to get rich as well. You know, there's this kind of idea of trickle down. And, you know, they do need to tell these stories. So they invest huge amounts of money in think tanks, in universities, in just generally trying to change people's minds about what's important and trying to put a financial view out there. And often you get, you know, when a political event happens, I see it a lot in my own country, and it also happens a lot here. When something happens, you know, the media will call up an analyst, but they won't call up, you know, if you have a plane crash or something, you know, the 737 crash, you know, very often they won't call up an engineer. They'll call up someone from Wall Street or the City of London to analyze this. And very often, you know, these players are kind of the part of the problem. They are the ones who are calling for money to be taken out of these companies to, you know, which results in, you know, a loss of investment. And in the case of, you know, the 737, for example, yep. there's a strong case for saying that you know, safety standards were reduced because so much money had to be paid as dividends to shareholders in Wall Street.
You cite Bill Lozanik, who's been a guest multiple times on this show, who recently wrote a piece about that very issue with the 737, that the company had the opportunity, I don't know if it was a decade or two ago, to make some structural changes to the planes that were a function of changes in U.S. airports. They decided, rather than to overhaul their planes, they cut some corners, and they figured they could do a software patch, essentially, to deal with this this slight redesign of their plane, and we saw what happened.
Exactly, yes. And Bill Lozanik, as much as anybody, has done fantastic research. And his, you know, his big thing is shareholder value, this idea that what matters is wealth coming out for the owners, you know, for the shareholders. And this is all about extracting wealth. You know, in the book, I make this great contrast between wealth extraction and wealth creation. You know, wealth creation is the stuff we need in our economy. This is, you know, productive things being done, creating new widgets and services and all sorts. But then the extractors come along and they start sucking the wealth out of you know, out of businesses and so on. And this has not only economic dimensions, it not only reduce, you know, does things like reduce overall economic growth and increase inequality, but it has very powerful geographical effects, because the extraction often happens from poorer parts of the country and is channeled to the richer parts of the country. But also it has racial dimensions. You know, the people, the most vulnerable people tend to be the ones extracted from. It has gender dimensions. You know, any kind of dimension of, you know, discrimination and inequality and so on, you will find that the finance curse worsens these dimensions in very hidden ways, often ways you don't, you know, they're very complicated to understand in their details. But I think ultimately it's a pretty simple concept. It's just, you know, money is being extracted from these communities, these areas, these you know, groups of people, and channeled to a relatively small group of, you know, mostly middle-aged white men in the big money centers.
And in your conclusion, I mean, you lay out some just sort of broad principles, I think, that we could follow to at the very least fix this ill of financialization, which essentially, you know, are in many ways just reimposing reforms that we had prior to, I don't know, the early 70s and through the 80s. I mean, things like stock buybacks, they were once illegal. They could be illegal again. A perspective on antitrust that looks at all of the implications of monopolization rather than just how cheap it is for people in the short run. What else is key in your mind?
Yeah, no, I think those are all very important. I think, you know, ultimately the most important thing is a reframing exercise. And I think that is definitely going on in the United States and the United Kingdom and other places. There has been this idea of, you know, the billionaires and the large multinationals as the wealth creators. But if we can start reframing them very significantly as the wealth extractors, you know, these are the people who, you know, one of the big secrets of the wealthiest people in this country is they don't like free markets. What they like is rigged markets. And I think people are increasingly able to see this. And once we can move away from the idea that we need to sort of support these rich people as the wealth creators and look at the wealth extraction strategies that they are involved in, monopolization and the use of tax havens and all these things that they're doing, we can actually start seeing that there's a whole load of democratic possibilities that become open to us, that we can start raising tax rates on wealthier people, and on multinationals. We can start putting in place strong antitrust and things like that. And not only will that reduce inequality and redistribute money towards and income and power towards, you know, the middle classes and ordinary people, but it will also increase overall economic growth and prosperity. It's kind of a win-win. And I think people at the moment are a bit hamstrung by the idea that if we, you know, tax the billionaires and do it too much, we'll damage economic growth. But once we realize that we can bring back democracy, we can have both redistribution and you know, reduced inequality, but also higher economic growth and higher prosperity. There's really nothing to stop us.
Nicholas Shackson, The Finance Curse, How Global Finance is Making Us All Poorer. We'll put a link at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Great to talk to you. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
There you go, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Head to the fun half, wherein we will have some fun. Just some programming notes. Right now, on Wednesday, it appears that Bill Taylor, the ambassador or former ambassador who was brought back to professionalize the so-called drug deal that Rudy Giuliani was up to in Ukraine, will be testifying publicly on Wednesday. In addition, Bill Kent, William Kent, is that his first name? George P. Kent, who is a State Department official, who is going to testify, I believe, as to sort of the attempts to get rid of the first EU, successful attempts to get rid of the first EU ambassador. They are putting together the case that Donald Trump extorted, bribed two different sides of the same coin, or attempted to. Get the Ukrainians to, at the very least, say there was an investigation into the Bidens and there was an investigation into the 2016 election, so as to apparently give something for Donald Trump to run on in 2020. Now, apparently Lev Parnas today or yesterday, or I guess Friday, testified something to the effect of that Rudy Giuliani was pushing for a quid pro quo. I need to look more into that. I did portray Lev Parnas on Halloween because I saw a picture of him with a medallion. That was the only thing I had. Good to know that's getting into the news more so that people can, in retrospect, appreciate my costume even more. We will do live streaming of those hearings. I think they start at 10 a.m. on Wednesday. I'll be in and doing that, and then we'll see as we get closer to the show. We were planning a news day for Wednesday anyways, so we will see what's happening. But I'm going to be watching those, so if you want to watch them with me, you will have the opportunity to do so Wednesday morning. And aside from that, everything will be regularly scheduled. Thursday, we may be starting just a little bit earlier, and we may flip things. We'll do the fun half for live viewers first and the interview second. So just set your calendars and your clocks and all that. I know everybody is doing that. So
like eating dessert first.
And so we're going to have eat dessert will come first on Thursday. In the meantime, just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you become a member, you not only support the free show, you get it without commercials. You also get extra content every day, and you help this show grow. And we've added the AM Quickie. Folks are enjoying that. You can sign up for that at amquickie.com. You can access it through the app. Should tell you that the iOS and the Android apps have been going through continuous, what seems like just like nonstop updating. If you downloaded it a day ago, update it now. All the features that you loved before and more are there on the Majority app. So check that out. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. So check that out. Today is Monday, which means that tomorrow is Tuesday, but the show is not happening on Tuesday. It's happening today on Monday.
Indeed. Schedule change. Richard Wolf is here. Shahid Buttar is here in studio.
Oh, really?
Actually, and I should let everybody know, tomorrow I'm emceeing an event at Catch Historia in Queens for Shahid Buttar. It'll be like a small grassroots fundraiser. And I know Nomiki's going to be there, Isaiah James, who's a great progressive running for Congress, and Peter Dow. So
Chairman
Peter Dow, man, he's on it. He has not played around with his transformation.
Welcome to the left. See the left. Welcome to with open arms.
Absolutely. I look forward to shaking Peter Dow's hand. So we're going to be talking extensively, obviously, on the coup in Bolivia, on Lula, and then with Richard Wolf, we have some broader themes to hit, including the history. What exactly was the Soviet Union? And he's going to give us an introduction to the 18th Brumaire by Marx. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Pre-stream starting at 6. Become a patron. Get the whole thing. Get your tickets to the Philly Live Show November 23rd with Crystal Ball, Emma Viglin, Artesia Balthrop. All links are on the website.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, Sean had on some of two of his fellow building tradesmen to talk all things union. They discuss their own work histories and how they became radicalized through their experiences. Sean actually met one of these guys at a Capital Reading Group, so that's cute. They poke holes in this J.D. Vance white working class mythos that sees cultural regression and Trumpism as a sort of essentialist thing divorced from material factors. And they talk about the structures they've encountered in their particular unions and how the working class can overcome the provincialism and conservatism of business unionism. Because as we know, some of these trades unions can be very conservative, and that's not what we want. Also, Sean did a bonus with Billy O'Connor where they talk some more about some of their experiences on the job and in the union, in the trades. Also, I just recorded an episode over the weekend with all three members of the Trillbilly Workers Party podcast, and I'm very excited about that. And that's going to be up for all of our patrons on Friday.
Matt.
Yeah, folks, check out my Salem Witch Trials episode. And also coming up, it's going to be released probably sometime this week for members and then on Saturday for everybody. But Afro Ben, her story, Orinoco, the Royal Slave. It's one of the early examples. It's not quite a novel, but it's an early example of prose fiction, and it's about a slave that gets captured, and it's bad because he's actually royalty. So it's not really an anti-slave narrative like some people like to think it is. But
don't give it away for free.
But yeah, okay, yeah, you'll check that out. So look forward to that, folks.
Oh my God, can I make one more recommendation? I totally forgot. If you want to understand the neoliberal turn of the 1970s from a Marxist perspective, check out History as a Weapon, Pivotal Decade, the 1970s with Sean KB and Matt Chrisman. It's very good.
Also, Globalists on MR and Quince Lodian's essays.
This episode is brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them down into just 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now, but there's room for you. It has massive growing library from self-help to business to health and history books. Right now, you can get 25% off your first year at Blinkist.com/majority. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Cannot hustle.
Come on!
Fuck
them,
fuck
them,
fuck them, fuck them, fuck them, fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, total, 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 pussy.